A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I don't think I've ever gotten off a plane without a scratchy throat. It's one of those things where you board feeling fine, you land feeling like you swallowed sandpaper, and nobody really questions why we've just accepted this as normal. Daniel's been thinking about it too. He wants to know why modern HVAC can't solve this at altitude. Why do we keep getting sick or dried out? And the part that really got me, cabin crew and pilots breathe this air for a living. How are they not down with a cold half the time? Do they build up some kind of resistance, the way daycare workers do after a year or two of constant exposure?
There's actually a lot packed into that question, because the dryness problem and the infection problem are two different things that trace back to the same root cause. And the crew immunity question. The daycare comparison is the right instinct, but it doesn't quite map the way you'd expect.
So where do we even start with this?
Start with what the cabin actually is. You're in a sealed aluminum tube at 30,000 feet where the outside air is minus 50 Celsius and so thin you'd lose consciousness in under a minute. Every molecule of air you breathe in that cabin has to come from somewhere, and there are only two sources. Either it's bled from the engine compressors, what's called bleed air, or it's recirculated through filters. That's it. There's no window to crack open.
Bleed air sounds vaguely alarming if you don't know what it means.
It's not as bad as it sounds, mostly. The engines compress outside air to extremely high pressure and temperature, around 200 degrees Celsius, and a portion of that gets tapped off before it enters the combustion chamber. It's cooled through heat exchangers, then mixed with recirculated cabin air and sent into the cabin. On most aircraft, about half the air is fresh bleed air and half is recirculated through HEPA filters.
And those HEPA filters are the part the airlines like to talk about. They catch 99.97% of particles down to 0.3 microns. Bacteria? Viruses? The works?
Right, and that's good filtration. Better than what you're breathing in most office buildings. The air in an aircraft cabin is replaced completely every 2 to 3 minutes, which is also better than most indoor spaces. ASHRAE Standard 161-2018 governs all of this. It's the specific standard for aircraft cabin air quality, and it's stringent.
So if the filtration is that good and the air turnover is that fast, why am I blowing my nose 2 days after every flight?
Because HEPA filters don't catch everything, and they don't address the thing that's actually compromising your defenses. Let me separate these two problems. The infection problem, catching a cold, is mostly about proximity. You're sitting inches from strangers for hours, someone 3 rows back sneezes, and droplet nuclei can be smaller than 0.1 microns. Below the HEPA cutoff. The filter isn't catching those before they reach you if they're generated 5 feet away.
So the filter is cleaning the air that passes through it, but it's not cleaning the air between me and the guy in 14B who's been coughing since takeoff.
And there's another gap. HEPA filters are particle filters. They don't remove gases. At cruise altitude, ozone concentrations are much higher than at ground level. That ozone gets into the bleed air. There are also volatile organic compounds from cleaning products, de-icing fluid residues, and occasionally breakdown products from engine oil. Trichloroethyl phosphate is the one that gets attention in fume event investigations. None of that gets caught by a particle filter.
And then there's the dryness, which is the thing I actually feel in my throat.
This is where the engineering constraints get brutal. At 30,000 feet, the outside air is minus 50 Celsius. At that temperature, air holds almost no water, less than 0.1 grams per cubic meter. When you bring that air into the cabin and warm it to a comfortable temperature, the relative humidity plummets. Typical cabin humidity during cruise is 10 to 20%. For comparison, a comfortable indoor environment is 30 to 50%. The Sahara Desert averages around 25%.
So it's drier than a desert.
Drier than most deserts, yes. And the reason we don't just add moisture is weight, corrosion, and ice. To humidify a full cabin to even 30% relative humidity for a long-haul flight, you need to carry hundreds of pounds of water. Water is heavy, fuel is expensive, But even if you solved the weight problem, you'd create new ones. Humid air at altitude hits cold surfaces in the ductwork and freezes. It condenses in the insulation blankets around the fuselage and causes corrosion. It creates microbial growth in the humidification system itself. Airlines have looked at this for decades, and the conclusion keeps coming back the same. It's not worth the trade-offs.
And the dryness isn't just uncomfortable. It actually makes you more vulnerable to whatever pathogens are floating around.
This is the part that connects the two problems. Your respiratory tract has a built-in defense mechanism called mucociliary clearance. The cilia are these tiny hair-like structures that beat in coordinated waves, moving a layer of mucus upward and out of your airways, trapping and removing particles and pathogens. That system depends on the mucus having the right viscosity. When the air is too dry, the mucus thickens, the cilia slow down, and your first-line immune defense is compromised.
So the dry air doesn't give you a cold. It just takes the bouncer off duty.
The pathogens are still coming from the sick passenger, but in a properly humidified environment, your respiratory tract might have cleared them before they established an infection. In 10% humidity, that mechanism is impaired within 2 to 3 hours.
There was a study on this, wasn't there? The German one.
The 2013 DLR study, the German Aerospace Center. They sampled 63 long-haul flights and found that bacterial and fungal loads in cabin air were actually comparable to what you'd find in an office building. The air wasn't dirtier. But the combination of low humidity, ozone, and confined proximity created a unique exposure profile. Passengers showed measurable mucosal irritation and reduced immune function within a few hours. It wasn't that the air was full of pathogens. It was that the air was undermining their ability to fight off whatever pathogens were there.
Which brings us to Daniel's second question, the crew. If I'm getting sick after a few hours in this environment a few times a year, how are flight attendants and pilots not permanently ill?
The evidence here's mixed, and the more you dig into it, the more complicated it gets. A 2018 study in the Journal of Occupational Health found that cabin crew do report upper respiratory symptoms at higher rates than the general population. That's the headline finding, and it makes intuitive sense. But the same study found something else. Crew with more than 5 years of experience had lower symptom rates than new hires.
So something changes.
Something changes. The question is, what? The daycare worker comparison Daniel raised is the natural parallel. Daycare workers get hammered in the first year or two, constant colds, stomach bugs, everything the kids bring in. Then their illness rates drop dramatically and eventually approach normal. That's adaptive immunity. They've been exposed to a high diversity of viral strains at high doses, and their immune system has built up a broad repertoire of antibodies.
But you're saying the crew trajectory doesn't look like that.
It doesn't. Crew are exposed to a lower diversity of strains, mostly whatever respiratory viruses passengers are carrying, and at lower doses because of the HEPA filtration. The adaptation that seems to be happening isn't primarily about building antiviral immunity the way daycare workers do. It's more about the respiratory tract itself adapting to chronic dryness and ozone exposure.
Adapting how?
The mucosal epithelium can thicken over time with chronic exposure to dry, irritating air. The tissue becomes less sensitive. Mucus production patterns change. It's not that the immune system is better at fighting viruses. It's that the physical barrier has adapted to the environmental stress. But this comes with trade-offs.
What kind of trade-offs?
The 2015 Flight Attendant Health Study. This was an NIH-funded longitudinal study that tracked chronic conditions in cabin crew over years, found that senior crew had lower rates of acute illness but higher rates of chronic respiratory conditions. Sinusitis. Asthma. Persistent rhinitis, so you're trading fewer colds for long-term mucosal damage. That's not the same as building immunity. That's your body developing calluses, essentially, and calluses aren't free.
And there's another factor that messes with the data, right? The healthy worker effect.
That's a huge confound. Crew who get sick frequently in their first year or two tend to leave the profession. The ones who stay are self-selected. They're the people whose respiratory systems could handle it in the first place. So when you study senior crew and find they have lower illness rates, you're not necessarily measuring adaptation. You're measuring survival. The vulnerable population already quit.
So the data on crew immunity is partly real adaptation and partly statistical artifact.
And the adaptation itself is a mixed bag. Fewer colds, more chronic conditions. It's not a clean success story.
What about pilots specifically? They're in a different part of the plane.
Pilots have a distinct exposure profile. Cockpit air on most aircraft is 100% bleed air, no recirculation. That means they're getting more fresh outside air, which sounds better, but it also means they're getting more ozone at cruise altitude. The FAA mandates ozone converters on most commercial aircraft to catalytically break down ozone before it enters the cabin, but these converters degrade over time and aren't always replaced on schedule.
How quickly do they degrade?
It depends on the route. High-latitude flights and polar routes have higher ambient ozone, so converters degrade faster. There have been studies showing that on some older aircraft, cockpit ozone levels can exceed FAA limits by a factor of 2 or 3 during certain seasons. And ozone is a powerful respiratory irritant. It causes inflammation, reduces lung function, and over time contributes to the same chronic conditions we see in cabin crew.
The 787 changed some of this, didn't it?
The Dreamliner is the first major commercial aircraft with a bleedless architecture. Instead of tapping air from the engines, it uses electric compressors to pressurize cabin air. That eliminates the engine oil contaminant pathway entirely. No more tricresyl phosphate concerns. But it doesn't solve the dryness problem. The outside air is still minus 50 and bone dry. You're still at 10 to 20% humidity. The 787's cabin is pressurized to a lower altitude. Equivalent, 6,000 feet instead of the typical 8,000, which helps with comfort, but the humidity issue remains fundamentally unsolved.
Because the humidity problem isn't an engine problem. It's a physics problem.
It's a water problem. And water is heavy, water freezes, water corrodes. Until someone invents a lightweight, freeze-proof, corrosion-proof humidification system that doesn't require carrying hundreds of extra pounds, cabin air is going to stay dry.
So where does that leave the crew who are in this environment 70 to 100 hours a month?
Some of them develop their own workarounds. And this is where the data runs out and you get into the realm of crew folklore. Nasal saline sprays. Menthol inhalers. Some crews swear by coating the inside of their nostrils with petroleum jelly before a flight to reduce moisture loss. Whether any of this actually improves mucociliary clearance in a measurable way, the studies are thin. But the instinct is right. If the problem is dryness impairing your mucosal defense, then mechanically restoring moisture or stimulating mucus flow should help.
Menthol specifically, does that actually do anything?
Menthol doesn't add moisture, but it activates the TRPM8 cold-sensitive receptors in the nasal passages, which creates a sensation of increased airflow and can trigger a reflex increase in mucus production. It's not humidifying the air, but it's tricking your body into mounting a response that partially compensates. Camphor and eucalyptus work similarly. It's not nothing, but it's also not a solution to breathing 10% humidity air for 12 hours.
I feel like we should talk to Ilbert about this. He's been quiet, but I know that look.
What look?
I did 6 months.
6 months of what?
Flight attendant. 1998. Charter outfit called Air World. Operated a handful of old 727s out of Gatwick, mostly to the Canaries and back. Went under in 99. I lasted 6 months because I couldn't stop getting sick. Every rotation, 3 days down with something. Sinus infections, mostly. One turned into bronchitis. The occupational health nurse finally told me my respiratory system wasn't cut out for it, and I should find something ground-based.
That's exactly the healthy worker effect in action. You self-selected out.
I did. But here's the thing. There was a woman on my crew, Brenda. She'd been flying 18 years. Never called in sick? Not once. She had this ritual before every flight. Vicks VapoRub, a dab inside each nostril. Swore by it. I thought she was nuts. But now I'm sitting here listening to you two talk about mucociliary clearance and menthol receptor activation, and I'm wondering if Brenda wasn't just mechanically restoring what the dry air was taking away.
18 years and never sick. That's either luck or something real.
It could be both. The menthol stimulates mucus flow. The petroleum base probably provides some physical barrier against moisture loss. But she might also just have had a respiratory system that was unusually resilient to begin with. The people who stay in the job for 18 years aren't a random sample.
That's the part I wanted to mention. The survivor bias. You touched on it, but I think it's bigger than you're giving it credit for. The crew you study after 5, 10, 15 years, those aren't adapters. Those are the ones who didn't break. The rest of us are working in call centers or producing podcasts. You're studying marathon runners to understand what running does to knees, and you're only looking at the people whose knees didn't give out.
That's a fair point. The longitudinal studies try to control for it by tracking cohorts from entry, but attrition is high in the first few years, and the reasons for leaving aren't always documented as health-related. Someone quits because they're tired of the lifestyle, but the lifestyle was making them sick. That doesn't show up in the health data.
Did you ever try the Vicks thing?
I thought she was crazy. I was 23 and knew everything.
Of course.
She gave me a little jar of it once. I used it for one flight, decided it felt undignified, and went back to being sick. I still have the jar somewhere.
Brenda might have been onto something. Not the Vicks specifically, but the idea of personal protective measures that address the dryness directly. Nasal sprays that actually restore mucociliary function, rather than just adding moisture temporarily.
There's been some work on this. Saline nasal irrigation has decent evidence for reducing upper respiratory symptoms in general. In dry environments specifically, isotonic saline sprays can help maintain mucus viscosity. The limitation is duration. You'd need to reapply every couple of hours, and most passengers and crew aren't going to do that.
But crew might, if it meant the difference between functioning and not.
Crew might. And some airlines have started paying attention to this. Not to nasal spray specifically, but to the broader question of what can be done within the existing engineering constraints. Antimicrobial surface coatings on tray tables and armrests. Better ozone converter maintenance schedules. On the 787 and A350, the higher cabin pressure and slightly better humidity retention from composite fuselages help at the margins. But the air itself, that's still the hard problem.
The composite fuselage helps with humidity.
Marginally. Aluminum fuselages condense moisture out of the air because the skin gets so cold at altitude. Composites have better thermal insulation properties, so the inner skin stays warmer and less moisture condenses out. It's not a huge difference, maybe a few percentage points of relative humidity, but it's something.
And the next generation?
The real shift will come when more electric aircraft architectures become standard. The 787 proved the concept. When you decouple cabin pressurization from engine bleed, you eliminate the contaminant pathway entirely. No more engine oil breakdown products. No more de-icing fluid ingestion. The air is cleaner at the source. But you still have the fundamental physics problem. Outside air at altitude is dry, and humidifying is heavy.
So we're stuck with dry cabins for the foreseeable future.
For the foreseeable future, yes. What might change is how we protect individuals within that environment. Better personal humidification. There are portable ultrasonic humidifiers now that run off USB, though they're tiny. Nasal barrier sprays that are actually formulated for long-duration dryness rather than just decongestion, and honestly, just awareness. Most passengers don't know that the dry air is compromising their defenses. They blame the recycled air, which is mostly a myth. The air is being replaced constantly. They don't realize that drinking more water and using a saline spray could actually reduce their odds of getting sick.
The recycled air myth is interesting. People think they're breathing the same stale air for hours.
It's the opposite. The air in an aircraft cabin is replaced far more frequently than the air in your living room or your office. The problem isn't staleness. It's that the fresh air being pumped in is desert dry and carries whatever the guy in 14B just exhaled.
And the crew who breathe this every day, they're not immune. They're just the ones whose bodies found a way to cope, and some of those coping mechanisms have a shelf life.
The chronic condition data bears that out. Senior crew have lower acute illness rates but higher rates of sinusitis, asthma, chronic rhinitis. That's not a picture of robust health. That's a picture of a population that's adapted to an extreme environment at a cost.
The daycare worker comparison Daniel made is actually useful precisely because it doesn't match. Daycare workers build broad immunity and eventually return to normal illness rates with no apparent long-term damage. Crew show a different trajectory entirely. The adaptation is real, but it's not the kind you want.
It's the difference between training your immune system and wearing down your mucosa. One is adaptive immunity. The other is, I don't know what to call it, acquired tolerance maybe. But tolerance isn't the same as health.
So, if you're a frequent flyer listening to this, what's the takeaway? You're not going to become a crew member with adapted mucosa from flying twice a month.
Hydrate more than you think you need to. Saline nasal spray before and during the flight. Avoid alcohol and caffeine, which are diuretics and make dehydration worse. And if you're really prone to post-flight illness, a barrier ointment around the nostrils isn't crazy. The evidence is thin, but the mechanism is plausible. Mostly, understand that the dry air is doing more than making you uncomfortable. It's temporarily disabling one of your immune system's front lines.
And for the engineers working on the next generation of aircraft, the humidity problem is still sitting there, unsolved. Nobody's figured out how to add moisture without adding weight, ice, and corrosion risk. That's a hard problem.
It is, and it's worth solving. Not just for comfort, but because there's a real health cost to spending hours in 10% humidity. We've optimized cabin air for weight and fuel efficiency. We haven't optimized it for the human respiratory tract.
Hilbert's Brenda might have had the right idea after all. Low-tech, personal, targeted at the specific mechanism that's failing.
She retired at 62 with full benefits and no chronic respiratory conditions. I checked. She's still alive, still in good health. I found her on Facebook a few years ago. Never mentioned the VIX. Should have asked.
18 years of menthol and petroleum jelly. A cohort of one. Not exactly publishable.
No, but she was right about something.
She was right that the problem is personal and local. The air in the cabin is what it is. What you do at the point where it meets your respiratory tract, that's where the leverage is, at least until someone solves the physics.
That's where this is heading, I think. The big engineering solutions, bleedless architectures, better filtration, higher cabin pressure, those are already happening. The next frontier is individual protection, nasal barrier products that are actually evidence-based. Personal humidification that works for more than 20 minutes. Maybe even real-time cabin humidity monitoring that lets crew know when conditions are particularly bad on a given flight.
The 787 and A350 move the needle on cabin pressure and air quality at the source. The next generation might finally tackle humidity, but I wouldn't hold my breath. The weight penalty is brutal and fuel isn't getting cheaper.
There's some research into membrane-based humidity recovery systems, capturing moisture from outgoing cabin air and transferring it to incoming fresh air. The technology exists for buildings. Scaling it down to aircraft weight and reliability requirements is the challenge. But if someone cracks that, you could maintain 30% humidity without carrying water. That's the holy grail.
Until then, we're all breathing desert air at 30,000 feet and wondering why our throats hurt.
The crew who do it every day are paying a price we're only starting to quantify properly. Lower acute illness, higher chronic conditions. It's a trade-off, not a superpower.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for the Brenda story. I'm going to be thinking about Vicks VapoRub for the rest of the day.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us a question like Daniel did, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.